The night Martin Luther King was shot, four of us, small town, small college white boys, were following the Gulf's eastern shore on an all-night trek from South Florida to New Orleans. It was spring break, 1968, 50 years ago. We heard about King's death over the AM band, the only band, on the console radio in that 62 Chev with the Sioux County plates. We were on our way to New Orleans' French Quarter, Sin City, four lusty guys, tired and sunburned, traveling along some several hundred comfortable miles south of our own birthright Dutch Reform Christianity. From the time we'd scarfed down cheap burgers for late supper through the next morning's first whispered glow, that radio kept spilling news about King's death, news stories interrupting music, statements being read by just about anybody important enough to merit airtime, memorials, and obituaries. James Earl Ray had killed Martin Luther King outside the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, not all that far north of us, it seemed. The sun wore a heavy mask of gulf fog that morning when light opened our eyes to the coast. I don't remember where we were, but the chore of keeping ourselves awake made us pull over at the nearest dive, however seedy. It was still before six. Two guys kept right on sleeping in the Chev's back seat, but two of us walked up to the door of a greasy spoon and found it very much awake. What we saw inside remains the most vivid picture I took during the 1968 spring break. Place was full of rednecks, open bottles standing on the table, even though it was a cafe and not a bar. A sign up near the cash register claimed proceeds that day would go to the Ku Klux Klan. The jukebox wailed out music I'd never heard before, half rock and roll, half country, lyrics thick with racist spit. I remember wanting to write down the words as we sat there and waited for hotcakes, but I was too bloody scared. These guys were the kind of men other guys know are dangerous just by sight. We'd walked into an all-night party, all male, all white, all hate, in celebration of the death of Dr. King in a mass of blood on a motel balcony. We sat quietly and ate a breakfast served up, ironically, by a cook whose black face appeared, then disappeared above the window shelf where plates of breakfast came up miraculously from the back. The partiers, half-potted, were oblivious to us. As I remember the place now, a half century later, we ate hotcakes in fear and shock of what was happening all around, as if some omniscient drama director had staged this play for us. But it was no play. That's what I remember about the night Dr. King was murdered, that scene and those men. That's what I know of unalloyed racist hate. But Martin Luther King had come into my life several years earlier when my friend's father, a good man, asked me to go along to a meeting spread around in whispers and fleeting glances, a get-together of like minds in a mansion on the bluffs above Lake Michigan in a small Wisconsin city near the town where I grew up. Mid-60s, in the middle of the Cold War, and I was barely 16, an evangelical Christian boy, a sworn enemy of atheistic communism, a patriotic kid who wrote a civics essay about American responsibility in Southeast Asia in the face of the global communist menace. I still have that essay, written in a fine cursive hand. That night in the mansion, we sat on folding chairs in an upstairs room, straight rows, facing a screen. The meeting was opened in fervent prayer. I remember feeling excited about being in that place. We were banded together like the disciples doing upper room plotting to determine what measure of righteousness America needed. I was just a kid at a meeting, I later discovered, of the Sheboygan chapter of the John Birch Society. The feature that evening was a slide tape presentation featuring Martin Luther King caught in candid shots talking to people the metallic voice insisted were communists. This was Wisconsin, after all, home to Senator Joe McCarthy. The clearly stated message of that show I understood because my own father believed it, that behind the movement for civil rights loomed the Russian bear, atheistic communism waiting to devour the honey sweetness of liberty. King was a commie. I respected my father, as I did my friend's father, the man who'd asked me to come along to that upper room meeting. My memories are complicated by my respect for those men and their devotion, their love of country, of culture, and of home. But those two moments in my life, an all-night bayou drunken bash and an evening's Birch Society gathering, shrouded in secrecy, glutted with conspiracy theory, were both virulently racist. They clash in tone and spirit, but what separates them is threadbare. Most of us don't find hate attractive. All you need is love. Love redeems us. I've never felt any affinity with the men in the all-night diner, but I still admire the man who brought me along to the Birchers, even though that night, and forever since, I've not shared his politics. Racism is often the least recognizable and most unmanageable when it emerges from love. Hate is not one of the seven deadly sins, oddly enough, although it has a kissing cousin in wrath. The king of the deadlies to the world of medieval theologians and the world we know today is pride. Pride in self, first of all, but also pride in culture, in country, in race. Pride that sometimes shows itself as love, a clever disguise for its opposite. One dark early morning on spring break 1968, what I learned about belonging was at least something of what I wasn't, thank goodness, but also something of what I was. And I learned this, that life wasn't going to be easy, not for me or any of us.
Jim Scopp shared his story at Oat's live storytelling event last month. We'll have all new true stories being told on stage this Friday at the Marquee in downtown Sioux City. The theme is Lessons Learned. The show starts at 7 p.m. with live music by Alex Irwin of Ghost Cat. Find tickets at kwit.org. Support for Siouxland Public Media and Ode comes from Siouxland Woman Magazine, celebrating women, supporting diversity, and supporting the Siouxland Tri-State area. For more information about Siouxland Woman Magazine, visit their website at siouxlandwoman.com. The music is by Sean Blumberg, played live at Ode last year. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.
When there's nothing left to lose, I can fly right if I choose. You can buy, but you can't wear my shoes. Cause I've got nothing left to lose. So I'm heading home to lick my wounds. And share with my family the news. I put some miles on these here shoes. I've got nothing left to lose. So hop the midnight train down the coast. Well, I was still wrestling with your ghost. Caught me a bad case of the blues. When I had nothing left to lose, spinning circles in the sand. And down came a guiding hand. Show me the way, I was confused. When I had nothing left to lose, when there's nothing left to lose. You could fly right if you choose. Shame on me and shame on you. When there's nothing left to lose.
Thanks.